19. The CCTV footage of Erin's first visit to Leongatha Hospital on the morning of Monday, the 31st of July 2023, was released after the trial, and it's easy to find online. It's silent, but it tells the story. We jurors, of course, saw it at the trial. Erin is in her white pants and a red top. She's wearing her brown sandals that look like Birkenstocks, without socks this time. Her black handbag is slung over her shoulder and rests on her abdomen. Her black backpack is on her back. Veronica Foote, who had arrived only minutes earlier and had just taken over from Chris Webster as the on-call doctor for the day, is begging Erin to stay and receive treatment, but Erin is not interested. They are both wearing face masks. Dr. Foote has just heard about Ian and Heather's suspected death cap mushroom diagnosis from Dr. Webster. Outside the doors, we can see a fit young paramedic talking on her phone and a couple of ambulances. These are the ambulances that will soon transport Ian and Heather across to Dandenong Hospital. After several seconds of remonstrations, Nurse Kylie Ashton appears in a long, lightweight coat. Before this footage started, Erin had already been at the hospital for 3 or 4 minutes, and Kylie had done all she could. She had tried to get Erin to come through to the unit, but Erin had stayed on the seats opposite the nurse's station. As soon as she arrived, Erin had heard from Chris Webster that all her lunch guests were suffering from death cap mushroom poisoning. She was already itching to get away, even while Kylie took basic observations like her pulse, temperature, and blood pressure. Erin's pulse was 130. Her heart was racing. Mine would be too. Erin wasn't ready or willing to come through to obey for a more formal assessment at that point, Kylie explained to us at the trial. "Were you trying to get her to come through?" asked Jane Warren. "Yes, I was, because that would be generally where we would do assessments. Knowing what we knew about the other four members, it was pretty important to do a thorough assessment." Kylie talked with conviction. Her memory of this event, probably because it had been so unusual and unexpected, was vivid. "I talked to her about what was going on with the other members, let her know that they were quite unwell and that it was important we did that thorough assessment. Part of our initial conversation was, 'What brought you here? What are your symptoms? Can you tell me why you're presenting today?' And what were her responses?" "She told me that she'd been the fifth member of the lunch and that she had consumed the meal that was prepared and that she had had diarrhea and nausea since that occasion, but no vomiting." Kylie had continued trying to convince Erin to submit to a thorough assessment. "Given that everyone else was severely unwell," Kylie told us, "we needed to make sure that Erin was well, so we needed to bring her into a bay, and then she would probably need to go on the NAC treatment, like everybody else, even as a prophylactic, to make sure we preserved her liver from toxins. Then the plan was to potentially transfer Erin to a higher tier hospital for expert care." "It was a very short, rapid communication," Kylie continued. "But I explained that the other four people were very unwell and the two who were with us were in very poor condition, and we were prepping to transfer them to a bigger hospital for higher acuity care. I told her that her life was at risk. I was trying to communicate that as quickly and as seriously as I could, to try and make sure she understood that this was quite serious for her own health and well-being." "Despite that, did she still decline to move into a bay for examination?" asked Jane. "She did." "Did she give any other reasons?" "It was the same reason on repeat. 'I haven't come prepared. I'm not ready to be admitted. I need to go away and get things organised.'" But Erin did confirm that she had actually cooked the meal in question, and she also told Kylie that her children had not been present at the lunch, but that they had eaten the leftover Wellington parcels the next day. Without the mushrooms, she'd scraped those off. "Did you make any further attempts to get her into a treatment bay?" Jane persisted. Probably our whole interaction was me trying to communicate the importance of getting her thoroughly checked, Kylie emphasised. I was concerned for her welfare and really wanted to make sure we gave her the very best of treatment and got her the care she needed. But that still didn't cut any ice with Erin. She simply refused to stay. She had not come to hospital prepared to be admitted and needed to go away and sort out her children. Finally, Kylie gave in. She couldn't force her to stay. I asked her how long she needed before she could come back and consent to care, and she said around 20 minutes. Before Erin left, Kylie sought out Dr. Foote and asked her to speak with Erin. A last throw of the dice. Maybe someone with more medical authority might make a difference. Dr. Foote caught Erin just as she was about to leave, and that's the scene we saw on the CCTV footage. What was Dr. Foote saying? I relayed our concerns for her health and the potential that she could become very unwell, and that it was our medical advice that she stay and be further assessed and treated. She told the court. But she told me that she wasn't able to stay at that point in time. She had to go home and make some preparations for her animals and children, but that she would return. Kylie returned with a discharge against medical advice form, which Erin signed on the nurse's station desk. Kylie then hit the green button that opened the automatic doors, and Erin walked out. People discharge themselves against medical advice all the time. This is not uncommon. But it is uncommon if you have just been told you otherwise might die. On hearing that, I reckon most of us might think, you know what, the goat will be okay for a few hours. It eats anything. The dog doesn't need to be fed till tonight. Simon can pick up the kids. Bronte can miss one ballet rehearsal. I might just make sure I'm going to live. That could be a good use of time right now. But no, Erin was out of there, leaving behind one of the big questions of the whole trial. What had been going through her mind? Well, as soon as she had walked in, Chris had told her there was a concern her lunch guests had been exposed to death cap mushroom poisoning. I was shocked, she told us, but confused as well. I was just expecting to come in for some saline for gastro. Her shock is something I can believe. I'm sure a saline drip was all that she had been expecting. I didn't see how death cap mushrooms could be in the meal, and the information I had was that I had diarrhea. Don and Gail had been a bit unwell, but that's all I knew. Well, Simon had said that both Don and Gail had been admitted to hospital, so a bit unwell might be playing it down just a touch. And why Erin hadn't even asked about Ian and Heather is also odd, especially when she knew Don and Gail were both in hospital and her own tummy was a bit off too. And of course, Simon told us he had told her about Ian and Heather. On the other hand, the less she knew, the more credible and explainable her behaviour would be. So it was obviously in her own interests to play down as much as possible what she knew at this time and what she'd been told. Exactly who said what in this urgent rapid exchange, therefore, became a point of some contention. Kylie had sounded very convincing, but Colin Mandy, during his cross-examination, zeroed in on the constraints of patient confidentiality. If Kylie had told Erin any details about Ian and Heather's condition, or Don and Gail's, wouldn't she have been seriously overstepping that sacrosanct code of behaviour? Yes, Kylie had to agree. And Kylie Ashton wouldn't do that, would she? Kylie's response was sharp and precise. She hadn't told Erin any details of the condition of the other patients. All she had told Erin was that all four of her lunch guests were very unwell. Two of them had already been transferred to a larger hospital, and Ian and Heather were in the process of being transferred. Kylie had certainly made it clear again and again that it was a very serious situation, and for Erin's own safety, She needed to begin treatment as soon as possible. But Colin kept chipping away. Surely Kylie wouldn't have talked about any specific patients. Wouldn't that also have been a transgression? Kylie would have talked in the abstract, wouldn't she? Rather than talk about Ian and Heather in person. She's such a professional that surely she would have said something more like, people who have ingested deathcap mushrooms can become very unwell and need the resources of a large hospital. Kylie hedged a little at that and sort of agreed, although I couldn't help thinking that she really had said a bit more, as she had told us in her evidence. It was another example of someone remembering the gist of a tense, fast conversation they had had 2 years ago, but unable to say precisely what words they'd used. Erin, watching and listening to this exchange from the dock while Kylie was in the witness box, must have seen an opening. A few weeks later, when she was questioned about this first visit to hospital by Nanette Rogers in cross-examination, she went even further. I don't remember her, Kylie, talking to me about the others at all, she stated. And I remember feeling a little bit anxious because what was being communicated to me was that no one could tell me what was going on with the other people. Of course, if no one really had told her what was happening with the other four, and all she was hearing from Kylie was that she had to be admitted and then whisked off to a bigger hospital, that makes her resistance easier to understand. But that certainly wasn't the world that Kylie and Dr. Foote had painted for us. Whatever words they had actually used, they were very clear. They had let Erin know that it was a very serious situation. Time was of the essence. Her four lunch companions were very unwell and all of them needed high-level care in bigger hospitals. The sooner Erin also received that level of care, the better her outcome would be. And given she'd fed the leftovers to her children, the children needed to come in as soon as possible too. But Erin was adamant. That wasn't the conversation she remembered at all. I remember feeling very puzzled. Then someone said I needed to have a particular medicine and be sent straight up to Melbourne. I felt really anxious and stressed and confused. I felt really overwhelmed. The only other exhibit we jurors had to help us escape another he said, she said impasse here was the CCTV footage. Yes, it was silent, but when I looked at it again, to me at least it seemed that Dr. Foote was pleading with her and Erin was simply refusing to listen. Erin did not look like a woman who was confused and trying to work out what was going on. She might have been stressed, she probably was, and her heart was thumping. But to me, she looked like a woman who did not want to hear any more. Just shut up and let me go. I could see a bit of myself in that. Also, the ambulances that were about to take Ian and Heather to Dandenong Hospital were right there outside the doors as a physical reminder of how serious things were and how unwell Ian and Heather were. It's highly likely that Kylie had drawn them to Erin's attention. They're pretty hard to miss. And of course, we can consider the parallel reality. If guilty Erin now suddenly realised the medics already knew about deathcap mushrooms, and she knew that none of their tests were going to find anything wrong with her, that wasn't good. That'd be really damning. How would she explain that? Could she explain that? Guilty Erin would have suddenly needed time to think. This had not been part of the plan. She needed a new plan. But let's park that line of thought for a second. Let's keep presuming innocence. What did innocent Erin need to do back at home that took priority over saving her own life? During Erin's evidence in chief, Colin Mandy was meticulous about giving Erin the time and the space she needed to explain herself in detail. She couldn't simply give some wafty excuses. And to be fair, she didn't. Erin talked us through several well-defined tasks that she needed to tick off her to-do list. I'd just come into hospital for a couple of hours, Erin began. I've got kids at school. They've got all these activities. Like, I couldn't move my brain out of that being stuck in what I thought the day was going to look like. And it was kind of like trying to turn a really big ship. Like, it takes a long time. My intention was to go home, organize the things that I wanted to organize, and then come back. What things did she need to organize? I thought Bronte had a rehearsal for her ballet concert that afternoon or evening, so I wanted to locate the details for that, pack what she needed, in case I could contact another person to take her. I needed to organize my animals, like bring the dog in, feed him, put the lambs away, feed them. Lambs? What? Where did they get put away? I've got a shelter with a gate that I pen them into at night, keep them away from the foxes. So I didn't want to be overnight in Melbourne with them exposed, so I put them in their shelter with some hay. Well, I was right about the goat. It didn't score a mention. Goats obviously can look after themselves. But was this really what Erin was doing that morning? In the end, Erin didn't come back to Leongatha Hospital, ready to be admitted, until 9:48 a.m. She'd left at about 8:20 a.m. That meant she was somewhere, doing something, for about an hour and a half. Chris Webster had been on the phone to Beth Morgan when Erin walked out. He had just been telling Beth, with great relief, that the fifth member of Saturday's lunch party, Erin Patterson, had presented herself, and he was hoping that Dandenong Hospital had room to admit her. Dr. Morgan had finished her night shift and was heading home, but she had a better idea. She told Dr. Webster that Don and Gail's condition had continued to deteriorate, and they were both now in the process of being transferred again, this time from Dandenong Hospital to the Austin Hospital in Heidelberg. She suggested that he might skip the middleman and get Erin straight to the Austin. Dr. Webster knew what that meant. The Austin was the top of the tree. It was the only hospital in Victoria capable of delivering acute liver transplant services. Less than 48 hours after eating lunch, Don and Gail's condition had become critical. When Chris got off the phone, he was keen to talk to Erin immediately, which is when Kylie Ashton told him she'd left. Left? Scarpered. Signed the discharge against medical advice form and gone home. But she had said she'd be back. When? Kylie wasn't sure. They had sort of talked about her being back in 20 or 30 minutes, but Kylie was doubting whether Erin would stick to that. Chris was deeply worried. He knew Erin had also eaten the beef Wellington lunch she had cooked on the Saturday, and now two of Erin's guests were being transported to the Austin for emergency life-saving liver transplants. They really didn't have much time to make sure Erin avoided that outcome. He called Erin at 8:47 a.m, but Erin didn't pick up. Chris left a voicemail message pleading with her to return to the hospital. An agonizing 10 minutes passed with no contact from Erin. At 8:57 a.m, Chris called again, and still Erin didn't answer. So he left another message. More minutes dragged on. Chris was feeling the pressure. What to do? He couldn't just abandon Erin, even if she had walked out on them and she wasn't answering calls. In his eyes, they still had a duty of care to do what they could. While his mind was wrestling with this dilemma, he was also farewelling Ian and Heather. Ian was aware that Erin had made an appearance at the hospital because he had overheard the nurses talking about her, and they were all wondering why she had left and where she could have gone. But he hadn't seen her, and now he was off to Dandenong Hospital. Ian left in the first ambulance. As Heather was being placed in the second ambulance, Chris said goodbye and wished her well. "Thank you for looking after me," Heather whispered. At 9:23 a.m, Chris called Erin again. And again, Erin didn't pick up. This time, he left a different message. He explained apologetically that he only had her health and safety uppermost in his mind, but if she didn't return, he would have to call the police. Having left that message, Dr. Webster had to make sure he wasn't overstepping his authority. He called the CEO of Gippsland Southern Health, Louise Sparks, and the Director of Medical Services, Craig Winter. Getting the police involved in order to treat a patient against their will requires extreme circumstances and unanimous executive approval. It's not something any old doctor can just do when they feel like it. But they were dealing with a potentially fatal incident, and there were still so many questions that needed answering. With official approval, Dr. Webster called 000 a little after 9:30 a.m., and within 15 minutes, Constables Kate Mulry and Adrian Martinez Villalobos were heading out to 84 Gibson Street. By then, however, Erin was heading back to Leongatha Hospital. At 9:33 a.m., while Chris was on the phone to 000, Erin had called the hospital back. She couldn't be put through to Chris because he was on the phone, but she had indicated she would be there soon. So what had she been doing? One answer, of course, is that she had been doing exactly what she said she had been doing. She'd been feeding the dog, penning the sheep, and collecting ballet clothes. Intriguingly, Hogwarts professor of phone magic, Matthew Sorrell, had also been asked to see what could be gleaned from Erin's mobile phone tower connections during this critical hour and a half. As always, the answer was not conclusive. Phones can sometimes bounce around from tower to tower for the most capricious reasons. The data took half an hour to explain and involved an array of different directional antennas on base stations at Leongatha, Coonawarra, and Outram, and a mysterious gap between 8:55 a.m. and 9:23 a.m. when there was no record of where Erin's phone was at all. On Erin's behalf, Colin Mandy was quick to extract an admission from Dr. Sorrell that, under the right circumstances, it was possible to interpret this data as Erin simply moving around the different rooms of her house, and that couldn't be denied. That was a possibility. It was unlikely, but it was still a possibility. But what was the most likely interpretation? What trip would the phone have been undertaking for Dr. Sorrell to say it was most consistent with this sequence of connections? The answer was that her phone would have been going to the Coonawarra transfer station, the tip. Taken on its own, this was hypothetical. There was absolutely no corroborating evidence to suggest that Erin had dashed home to take a few pills that would give her a mild case of diarrhoea, then bundle up 4 grey plates and an orangey tan one, drive to the tip and chuck them in. There were tantalising half-clues to suggest she might have been doing something like that, but I couldn't send someone to jail for 30 years on tantalising half-clues. That would be outrageous. I was intrigued by this, but I was more intrigued by what Erin hadn't done. And this isn't guessing. This isn't a half clue. This is fact. Innocent Erin had just learned from Chris that her beef Wellingtons had been laced with deathcap mushrooms. This information had sent the medical teams into a spin because the smallest amount can be fatal. This was all unbelievably shocking. And on top of that, innocent Erin had fed the last Wellingtons to her children only the night before. Now, I know she had scraped all the mushrooms off. Yes, fine. But one small mistake here, one tiny bit of mushy still caught underneath, that's life and death. You're a parent, you love your kids. Erin does love her kids, and she knew the stakes here. She'd been told that in no uncertain terms. And yet she made no attempt to contact the school or to contact her kids or to drive there to pick them up and get them straight to a hospital. Nothing. They were safe. She'd scraped the mushies off. It was at this point I became, a bit of a quiet rebel. We had been told very, very strictly that the onus was entirely on the prosecution to prove what they were alleging Erin had done beyond reasonable doubt. Erin did not have to prove a thing. That was how the law worked. She did not have to prove her innocence. And I got that. I understood why the law worked that way. Trust me, I really did. But if you're a juror in a trial like this, with the evidence continuing to mount, There comes a point where you think, you know what, Erin? Now you kind of have to convince me you're innocent.